My guest today is a true pioneer. She's an actress, a model, and perhaps most importantly, an advocate for many marginalized communities. The person I'm talking about is India Moore. India was one of the stars of the FX TV series Pose, a groundbreaking show about New York City's legendary drag ball scene in the 1980s. India's exceptional career was not always a given. Her community growing up in the Bronx was very hostile to her trans identity, and as such, India has had to overcome countless hardships to get where she is today. A warning to you, dear listeners, that India and I are discussing many topics in this interview that can be distressing to hear, including physical violence, sex trafficking, and sexual assault. I want to just go over your kind of some of your amazing accomplishments, because you've got quite a lot of firsts here. You're the first trans person to be on the cover of Elle magazine. You're the first trans person to be signed by William Morris Endeavor, which, for those of you who don't know, is like one of the biggest acting agencies in the world. In 2019, you were listed as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. You're a brand ambassador for some major fashion labels, and soon you're going to be in a huge, giant budget comic book movie. That's just some of the things. You're smiling at me. How does that feel to hear some of your accomplishments?
It's a little nerve-wracking, you know, to be centered in this way. And I think, you know, it's always an honor to break through, but being the first, you know, I prefer things. It's amazing and it's exciting. It also, you know, like nerve-wracking, because I think about, like, I just, you know, I don't know, like, imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a pressure when it is a phenomenally heavy lift to create a path where there isn't one before you. So first of all, you have to there's that labor on top of just the labor of doing the actual job or doing the thing, right? And then when you are the first or one of the first, then that's a huge responsibility. And then people are looking to you always for like, well, what's the next first thing you're going to do? And you're like, you know, I don't know. I'm just kind of trying to process these things I've already just done here. You know what I mean?
Also, like, trying to enjoy life and find, you know, my own meaning in life and not just be somebody who, you know, contributes to the meaning of life for other people, but like also acknowledging myself as like a young person in the world trying to figure it out too.
So you grew up in the Bronx and you were raised in a family that was active Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you knew that your identity was going to be different from what your family expected from a very young age. And I'm curious how you navigated your life back then. Did you have one life that was for you and one that you presented to your family, or how did you navigate that time?
Really young. I was a young person, still coming into understanding what life is. And the more that I started to understand myself, I started to feel anxiety the more that I came into understanding that my feelings were possibly going to lead to my spiritual demise. That was like, I think, the earliest kind of fear and terror that I felt growing up, was like this anticipation that I was cut off from accessing God, going to be destroyed in Armageddon, mm-hmm. you know, because of my feelings, because I was assigned male at birth and I had feelings for like, I thought boys were cute. I mean, I thought humans were cute. You know, I just like was coming into like seeing like understanding what attraction is as a human being, but also becoming fearful that, you know, the way that I was growing up and the way that my sexuality had started to develop, that I was gravitating more in my interest toward boys. And going to the Kingdom Hall or church, you're taught that queer people won't inherit the earth, won't inherit the paradise. Growing up, being told that, or having that be an understanding, was really nerve-wracking and scary and traumatic. It wasn't something that I understood. It was something that, like, I grew up, I started to experience anxiety very, very young, and just really intense anxiety. Like, I started to feel really intense, like just really intense anxiety. And then that anxiety led me to feel like really deep shame. And that shame, like the only like the sh like the shame brought me to want to hide, myself.
That
But
all makes sense. Not to live authentically.
like, I couldn't be visibly attracted to boys. I couldn't actually talk about my feelings, because I learned very early that my feelings were wrong. It was just difficult. Like, I learned very, very young. I learned at a very young age to lie to survive.
And that you were
And
not okay. Fundamentally, who you were was not okay.
that who I was, right, what,
Yeah.
is not okay. It's like, that there's something wrong with me, and that I wasn't normal. It was very fearsome growing up, for sure.
You eventually left home when you were 14 years old. Is I'm assuming that a large part of why you left home at that age was just so that you could come out from under that type of living with that type of perspective. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't really a safe space for me. Besides, my sister was the only, like, person in my life at the time who challenged the way that we were raised to think and believe, not just by the Kingdom Hall, but at home. I think anyone growing up in the timeline of patriarchy, for sure is growing up in a home where, like, people, like, boys are taught to be men, and, like,
Right.
in aggressive ways, like, but yeah, like, I think I was also a victim of the ways in which boys are traumatized into performing masculinity.
Yes, very
Yeah,
much
like,
I understand
I
that.
think, but I think that this is like patriarchy is like really harmful to everyone, and, like,
Including the men.
including people who are assigned male at birth,
Yeah.
whether or not you are a man or a boy, like, it's really, really toxic. But especially if you aren't a man or a boy,
Absolutely.
masculinity is so often traumatized. People are traumatized into performing masculinity often. And, like, your attitude that is, deemed to be feminine or less than masculine, you're sort of like, shamed into changing your behavior, or you're shamed into adopting the behaviors of what it means to be a man. Like, you're, like, getting beaten. And for some people, like, some people may, some young boys, some young trans or queer people who are assigned male at birth may get beaten because they're showing emotion, because they're crying, because their bodies, respond to pain or hurt visibly. And then you're, like, beaten to be traumatized into not expressing your feelings. And, like, then it creates this toxic sort of cycle where you grow up ashamed of your feelings, and then you sort of project that shame outward if you aren't someone who, it's just for people in general that this happens to, but
Yeah,
especially if
absolutely.
you're not queer or trans, like, I experienced that, but I also experienced, like, the shame that my brother felt for being an emotional being. And like, you know, him seeing me and my emotions and seeing me and my expressions, he projected the shame that he felt about his own limitations and how much of his humanity he can access or be visible in on me. It's a really toxic cycle. It causes people to be very sad. And
yeah, very much so. I want to go back to when you were 14 and you left home and you were homeless for a while. And then you were also in the foster system, because that experience, I was in juvenile detention. I was in juvie when I was 15. So I was maybe a year older than you, but still I was 15 and going from like not having anywhere to live and also living on the street. And then I spent a year in juvie. That period of time shaped me in a way that was very significant, obviously, you know? And so I wonder for you what it was like being in the foster system at such a young age and how that shaped that sort of shaped you.
I just want to say, I'm really sorry that you had to experience that at such a young age. So happy for you now, like all grown up and in the position that you're in. A lot of us growing under those circumstances are challenged in developing the discipline required to survive in this world.
I feel it's important to talk about, and I talk about it because I am grown up in this world now, and I do have a life that I've managed to build through a lot of struggle and recovery and a lot of help and a lot of failing and a lot of pain. And I do talk about it because I want other people who may be in similar circumstances to know that it is possible to not only survive, but to have periods of time where you can thrive, even though your early childhood looked like maybe my did or yours did, or so many of us do. So I talk about it for that reason.
I'm starting to learn to talk about it for that reason as well. I think when I first started talking about it, I feel like I was asking for help more than anything. Mm-hmm. I feel like I was asking for help, and I feel like I was talking about it because it was something that happened to me that I knew wasn't supposed to happen to me. And I felt like nobody really knew, nobody understood. And
a lot of people won't understand. And I think because you're in a public situation now where what you say will go on record forever, everything that is said has to be really considered, because forever people will bring this up in your questions now. Like people bring it up in my questions when I get interviewed, and you have to kind of have enough peace with it yourself to be ready to talk about it from a place of not being in the panic and the chaos of it. And that takes time. So, you know, like you said, when you first started talking about it, maybe it wasn't fully processed for you. You were still like, this thing happened to me.
No, you know? It wasn't at all. You know, I mean, like people were asking me about my life and who I was, and I'm like, this is my life.
Yeah. And it's like, happening today. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like this is all I really have to talk about. And you know, like it's just really difficult to like be somebody who comes up from these experiences and to have only that to talk about when people ask you about who you are and what your identity is. Like you go straight to all of the worst things that ever happened to you, but like without really processing that they were really terrible things. It's just like, this is my life. This is, you know, what I'm made of, you know, these experiences. When I went into foster care, I was 14. I was really hopeful that I would have the freedom to be able to express myself and the safety to do it as well. I was categorically defiant at home because me being myself and expressing myself in the only ways that were true to me were constantly being identified as bad behavior and disobedience. Like I couldn't like bring a rainbow belt that was given to me as a gift to my house, and like these things were frequently used against me by my brother, or like, you know, my father, you know, really wanted to raise strong boys, and I wanted to raise a strong family and a normal family, and wanted us, my mom also like wanted us to be healthy and strong and normal and have great opportunities and to be focused in school. And I was so explosively curious, like, about life, and especially because I was so locked up in a house so much. Like,
it's also a beautiful quality to have, though, to be so curious about life. Like, think, you know, like you, like,
right.
Hope that we're that what a blessing to be curious. So much of the time, people aren't curious.
But that's why I feel like parents like forget that, you know, like parents, when, you know, when people become adults and they have their own lives and, you know, they were raised to think and do a particular way, they kind of forget that they forget the parts of their childhood where their curiosity wasn't honored. They forget the parts of their childhood where they were, you know, misled to believe that their interests didn't matter, you know, or like, you know, that they maybe those parents weren't protected. Maybe those parents were abused themselves and forgot what it was to be a child at all.
And that's then
when you have children, it's like, you know, they're curious and they're trying to learn, trying to figure out their existence. Like, oh my God, like, I'm in this planet. Like, oh my God, it's a planet. Oh my God, what's a planet?
Who am I? Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I'm in a city. Oh my God, I'm in the Bronx. Oh my God, there's more than this. Oh my God, there's more than me. Oh my gosh, you know, there's fashion, there's clothes, there's rainbows, there's colors. And it's like, you just want to have it all. You just want to get, and then like, it's like, but this is for boys and this is for girls. And you're like, wait, huh? And you're like, hold on. And then it's confusing. It goes back to like the ways that when your kid is like asking you questions and you're like, why are you asking so many questions? Like, stop. You know, I love my dad so much. And I also struggled with that with him, you know, like he didn't have time to answer a lot of my questions or to create space for me to learn about the things that I wanted to learn about and like express myself with, you know, like there were so many rules about the kind of human that you had to be. And I couldn't even question those rules, you know? So going into foster care for me was an opportunity to not have to follow those rules for me to be able to.
Was it freeing?
Was it for me to understand, you know, what was for me? I think there is a way that it was freeing, but I think like I didn't have a filter. I didn't have the protection of my parents anymore and the wisdom that they have, you know, in surviving and staying safe and staying alive, you know. And I met different people, you know, who had different agendas, and I ended up actually being sex trafficked when I was younger, when I was a teenager. And it was really easy for me to be sex trafficked and to be a sex worker as a teenager because people didn't consider me a child because I was queer, because I was trans. And like,
I'm sorry, you know, that happened to you.
Thank you.
I'm really sorry that happened to you.
Thank you. And, you know, I didn't really understand how I was being harmed, you know, like in that experience until much later, you know, like I just thought, oh, this is what, oh, okay. Like I was just learning and really vulnerable and not knowing, you know, like anything else. And was just like, oh yeah, this is the way that I'm going to survive. And they told me that if I want to be a woman, this is what I have to do to make money, you know, so that I can have, so I can like raise money to get breasts, and like in this convoluted way that, you know, the two men who were sex trafficking me thought that my, you know, thought what it means to be a woman or what my identity was about. And so like, you know, it was also like, I started to end up in conflict with them about what it means to be a woman. And like, you know, I didn't actually want certain things that they thought that I needed to have. And, you know, like, they assigned, you know, themselves in my life as like my gay parents, or like my gay father. It was like ballroom like sort of queer family, and they were putting me as a child through sex work.
And guess what? You were trying to survive. You know, that's the thing, is like, you were trying to survive. Literally, that was what was going on.
But I think, like, by this, at this point, I couldn't actually appreciate the home environment that I had access to.
Yeah. Did you appreciate it more after your period of time of not being in the home, of being in foster care?
Well, I think, yes. When I was transitioned out of foster homes and into the group homes, I started to have a greater appreciation to being in a home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, more than ever, I started to grieve my family, because I was like, you know, I felt like I was going to have a better experience, and it was actually terrible. And I imagined all the time, like, what it would be like to have affirming parents. And my sister was like my angel, my guardian angel, and my parent, you know, like, there were other things happening in my family where they were afraid, like, there was so much fear around me having access to people, other people who affirmed my identity, because they thought that I was going through a phase. And if people affirmed my gender identity, then it would make who I am a reality.
Yes, but it was threatening to them. Yes, it was threatening.
I was just grieving, you know, being home, because I imagined often what it would be like to just have my family and to be accepted and loved and to be able to be myself in an environment that was affirming, mm-hmm. you know, in an environment that was protective. And, you know, there were other trans people that I got to grow up with, that I got to explore arts with.
Yeah. Who was the people who supported you at that time?
There was this one girl named Ashley that I grew up. She was just so, like, funny. She was just like somebody that I had the most explosive experiences in humor with, like, and she was also a brilliant photographer. And so, like, she shot me a lot, like, in photos.
Is that how you got into modeling?
So, like, that was it's been mistranslated when I was talking about this experience in interviews.
Let's set it straight.
They misinterpreted this experience, because I've spoken about it before, as my beginning of modeling. But I was never a model when I was a teenager. I didn't start modeling until I was like 19 or maybe 20, or like 20 years old, really.
How did you start modeling?
I was taking photos with Ashley, we took really, really fun photos. It was really inspiring. And it made me believe in myself to be able to be a mom. But I was still in the thick of sex work, and I was starting to have really deep, serious disagreements with the people who were, I guess, pimping me, or like were my gay fathers at the time. And one day, I remember they were like, you know, you need to go to the doctor and start getting your hormones from there, because if something happens to you, because it's street, we don't want to be responsible. And then I said, well, I'm not old enough. And then they're like, well, you need to go try. And so I was 17 at the time. I went and I tried to get hormones through medical supervision instead of just off the street. I was denied because I wasn't an adult yet. I went back to the home with those two men. And then I explained to them what happened, and they were like that I was being lazy and I was making excuses. And I said, no, I wasn't. And you know, he told me to shut the F up. And I was like, don't talk to me like that, you know? And like, I was always really firm about the level of respect that I felt like I deserved with people ever since I was a child. I was very, very firm about that. And so when he told me to shut the F up, I pushed him out of my face because he was spitting. And he and his boyfriend jumped me. And then that's how I got this scar up the side of my lip. They had a ring on and they hit me on my face. And it was like really, really traumatic, like after, like being beaten. And like, I had a really incredible friend named Natalie, who was also a trans woman, who took care of me and with her mom. And I'm so grateful to them till this day. And I ended up staying with my former my like one of like my first boyfriend, he rescued me out of that situation, essentially, he and his mom. And so, you know, they took me under their wing and I got to stay with them, and they tried to get me to let me stay with them instead of having to be in foster care. That didn't work. Much, much later, we ended up having like a conflict of it wasn't even a conflict. Like, he wouldn't let me leave the home, his apartment. And he basically like held me hostage in the house. And I was like banging my head on the wall so that a neighbor could let me out or call the police or something. And so the police came, and I remember before the police came, I told him, I was like, you need to let me out of the house. So you need to let me out of the house. You can't keep me here. And I threatened to hit him with the hammer if he didn't let me out. And so like, I bluffed, I hit him like try to fake hit him with the hammer. Sorry, I'm laughing because it's kind of funny to me. And it bruised his shoulder a little bit. And it didn't like actually hurt him, but it bruised his shoulder a little bit. And then the police came, and I had bruises all over my body because he just finished beating me. We were fighting for me to get out of the apartment and he wouldn't let me out. And so when the police got there, I told them what happened. They immediately arrested him. And they asked me like, you know, they were, oh, he said that, oh, but she hit me on my shoulder. And then they were like, oh, you know, and they searched up my name. And I had a missing persons report made on me from the foster care agency because I was out for over 24 hours. So once you go AWOL, they have to create like this report.
How old were you then?
I think at this point I was like 18, almost 19 at this point. The police saw my name up on the system. And so they decided to arrest me and my former partner at the time. And so we were both in jail. The judge let him go and kept me for a week because they were afraid that I wouldn't show up to court.
You were a flight risk.
I was a flight risk to them because I was AWOL. So they sent me to Rikers Island. And I went to Rikers Island. And
how much time did you spend there?
I spent a week there. I begged them to put me in solitary confinement for my safety, and they did. But before I went to Rikers Island, before I went to the male part of the prison, they actually put me in the female part, Rosie's. And so they didn't know that I was trans because I was able to get my documents changed and updated at this time, at this point. They put me down for third degree felony because I hit him with a hammer. So even though he didn't like press formal charges on me, they still took the case. The state chose to press charges against me. And so they had it as a third degree felony, and they had to do a felony check. A felony check is when they basically have to strip search you and basically check you out naked. And so they put me in this area, like this space for me to put my legs apart. And they checked me, and the lady was like, we're going to send you to the doctor. And so she saw that I didn't have a vagina. And so they sent me to the nurse's area, and I was crying, and I was just like, please don't let them send me to the boys area. Like, you know, I'm going to be harmed really bad. I'm a woman, like I'm a girl, like I'm just X, you know, like my chromosomes are just XY, but I'm a girl, I'm a woman. And they were like crying with me. The nurses were actually crying with me, and they were like, oh my gosh, you know, so you're XXY. And then I said, no, I'm just XY. And they were like, wait. So they wiped. Literally, I swear to God, they wiped their tears and sent me to the boys part, the boys part of Rikers Island. So that's when I begged them to put me in solitary confinement so that I would be safe. Put me in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
There were these closed cells that, you know, just like individual. And I was next door to a boy that thought that I was cute, and like, you know, our little notes back and forth kept me afloat. There was also a really beautiful trans person that ended up coming later on, and I remember being so fascinated by how like femme presenting and like cis assumed they were to me, because they didn't like they weren't taking hormones. It was just incredible to me that there was another trans person in this space, and then that they weren't taking hormones either. Like I was like, oh my gosh. And so
This is
like
old by the time of you're 19.
yeah.
Oh my gosh, there's so much that you've experienced. I feel like I want like a
It's like
whole
it's not
day
even
talking to you. It's probably not even the tip of the iceberg. No, because this is all part of what shapes you, and it's really important. It's part of who you are. I'm just curious how you went from having that experience, being in jail, being in the foster system, like, how did you end up being somebody who auditions for Pose and getting that job in your life doing a 180? Like, how does that happen?
I always existed in the intersection of queer community and like the ball, like being like having the intersection to like queer to other queer and trans people, especially in ballroom. You know, no matter whatever happened to us, it never stopped us from being artists, right? Like, no matter how traumatic, no matter how dark or
Actually, that's the
deep.
lifesaver. The lifesaver is being an artist.
Yeah, I mean, like we always knew that, like, and I think I can say this for the rest of my community who can relate to some of these experiences. We always knew that no matter what we went through in the world, we didn't deserve to experience what we were going through. We didn't deserve the experiences that were happening to us. And we always knew that what was happening was wrong. And like, I think that in a way that preserves. It just like preserves a part of you that keeps your faith together, you know? I didn't like leave out of these experiences unscathed. Like, you know, it was just like misfortune after misfortune, but I knew that these things that were happening to me were wrong and that I didn't deserve to experience these things. And I was struggling with like trying to find joy and happiness. And I met some folks who like introduced me into to cocaine and drugs and like cocaine, just really cocaine. Cocaine was the only drug I like.
It seems like a good idea when you're looking for joy.
But 100%, you know, when you don't have access to safety, when you don't have access to other examples of joy, when you don't have money, you know, when you're a sex worker, like when you're trans, when you are existentially ostracized from all of the other functional parts of society, like, yeah, you know, you sort of end up being like, you sort of end up thriving in the most dysfunctional parts of society, so to speak.
Yes.
And a lot of that dysfunction like exists in the underground, but like also there's some structure, there's a presence, there's a family, there's a community, there's care, even within these pockets of struggle. You know, my community of people were all other people who were navigating drug abuse, who were navigating not having actual family, not having access to their immediate families. That, you know, we were all sort of in the same.
It was a tribe of people that you were able to relate to one another
Right.
and support.
I came to meet like other people in the ballroom community who, you know, who were extremely talented. And had dreams, no matter, you know, regardless of what they were going through. I saw a lot of the things that were happening around me. I didn't want to be my life. I didn't want that to be my life. And I started to see just things that I didn't like. I actually didn't enjoy the way that I looked in the mirror, struggling with cocaine. I didn't enjoy being a sex worker. I was ashamed. I felt like I was being sexually assaulted all the time.
Well,
You know, like,
you were.
well, consistently, you know, even
Yeah.
though I consented to doing it for money, I was crying so often while it was happening to me. I never really like
got to talk about it in a space where like people who cared about me had the capacity to hear it. It was really, really tough, you know? And I'm really proud of having memories of myself at some point in my life, not being in these situations, because I got to return back to that consciousness, the consciousness of who I was before I went into foster care, and the dreams that I had before they were stolen by these struggles and experiences. And so those dreams and that faith in myself was reignited by the artists, the other community members that I got to meet, like Jose Extravaganza, and just other trans and queer people who were actually trying to make it, or who saw more for themselves, you know? And
did you like, see a path out for you? Did you see people who were examples who you looked at and you thought, I'm interested in fashion, or I'm interested in acting. These are things I could do.
Well, I mean, like that wasn't the focal point of my dreams.
What was the focal point of your dreams?
I wanted to study biotech. I wanted to study biology. I wanted to go to school to learn how to heal people holistically. When I was sexually assaulted on my 18th birthday, and I healed myself from the STI, I had contracted a virus that I can't disclose, but I healed myself from it using just my prior knowledge of food medicine and just like on like Googling up, like just like
maybe you'll end up doing something like this. Maybe with your life experience, this is going to be in a weird way. Okay, let me just run this by you as a concept, right? When you've lived through the experiences that you've lived through and you have a healing ability, right? Which we're going to say that you do because of what your experience has been, in a really interesting way, just you existing in the world with your story and with what you've overcome and how you're healing, and healing is never done for us, right? It's like we're going to be doing it hopefully for a long, long time. In a weird way, you're acting as a healer by your existence.
I thought about that, you know, too. I had this conversation before.
Okay,
I
was good. I'm not completely off track.
No,
then.
It's really funny. It's really funny you say that, because I did think about it. I was like, well, you know, I still in some way am able to create some kind of healing for other people. But I really was actually into like physical health, like, and actually always wanted to be a naturopathic nutritionist or like a practitioner of holistic medicine. And that's what I wanted to do. But I never thought that I would be able to have the discipline to be in college. I never actually worked a real job, and every real job that I tried to get after being a sex worker, I always was fired. And I blamed myself like so much. I was so hard on myself because I could never keep a job. But, you know, I think I've glazed over that experience in my own life. And like it didn't actually have a real impact on my ability to hold discipline in a schedule. And I left foster care the same year that I started Pose, you know?
That's a lot of change. That's a lot of change.
I struggled a lot with showing up to work on time, you know, with like remembering my lines. I struggled with my reactions to any little injustice that I saw on set around me. Like it was just like a lot, you know, and I didn't have support. And even though we were literally telling a story about the experiences that I literally had and that I existed so closely to, it wasn't like I was 40 years out, you know, or 10 years out from that experience. Like it was literally it just happened to me.
Very close to home.
And so like, it was very, very close to home. And like, I was so hard on myself, and, you know, I'm just grateful for the people in my community who made that possible, you know, because if I didn't struggle in that experience, I wouldn't have had a place to grow from. And so, you know, like, even though it was really difficult, like that story that we were telling, that was me, It was, you know, I'm like, I'm that story that we were telling.
Yeah, and who though, better to tell it? You, if you had not lived through it, you could not have told it.
Right.
You're know, putting your like, story to use and being of service to people.
Jose Extravaganza sent me to audition for a film called Saturday Church. It's an independent film. And then I did with MJ, so I met MJ Rodriguez. And I Luca, the main character's mom, was a manager, and she sent me to the audition for Pose. And so, you know, that's how it happened. And I'm really grateful for, even though, like, I know that I frustrated Ryan Murphy. I know that I frustrated the network and my struggles and my challenges and all the ways that nobody around me knew how to support me or create space for what my challenges were at the time. I feel so grateful for them for any and all of the amount of grace that they gave me. Because if it was like, it couldn't have been a space for only trans people who had supportive parents and the discipline and the polish, you know, the experience to be in, because there has to be a place where we can start, you know, where those of us who are coming up out of abusive, traumatic backgrounds, where we don't know what discipline actually is because we were sex workers since we were kids. Like, there has to be something that we can start from, that we can grow from, you know? And I'm so grateful for everybody who, you know, fought for me even behind my back that I may not know about. Janet, you know, Steven, and even Ryan in the ways that he, even though he was so far from these experiences and ways, in some ways, I don't know his life story, they created so much space for me, you know, to grow and make mistakes and to improve. And
you were learning on the job. You were learning.
I mean, learning on the job.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a massive undertaking though. And the fact that you said yes, without the experience and having, you know, coming from a
who
life.
Would say that, no.
You know, someone who was too afraid to say
they
yes.
They said yes to me.
Right. But you also said yes. There was something like, there's something in you that said, okay, I'm doing this. I'm going for this. No matter what it's going to look like.
Yeah. I had no idea what I was. It was really scary because I had no idea what I was doing. And I was like, I honestly, like, imposter syndrome. I was like, I felt like I was a fraud. Like, felt like I was a fraud because I didn't have the experience of my peers, and I struggled like a lot. I didn't really understand what it took, you know, and I felt like, oh, somebody, you know, they're gonna rat me out, like, you know,
someone's
like,
gonna find out
worker.
Someone's gonna find out yeah.
that I'm not really an actor,
yeah,
you know, that I'm not, you know, really an artist. And this is what I told myself, you know, and like, I am just, I'm really grateful that I was able to grow, and that I, you know, it was always a dream. It was something that I've always wanted, you know, like I talked to my mom about, you know, and that I talked to my friends and my peers about. And
what do you dream about now?
I dream about being able to tell stories. I want to write about my life, and I'm gonna get it on TV so that people understand what's at stake for trans youth. I want to get my doctorates in biology still, and I want to study environmental sciences. I still wanna use my experiences to help people heal themselves. I wanna continue healing, and I want to learn to cultivate everlasting happiness and joy in a world that is uncertain. I wanna have love. I wanna have love that is safe. I wanna have love that is integral I want to have safety. I dream of being protected. I dream of having safety. I having grace from people, of being understood. I dream of people being able to really see who I am. And this industry and fame doesn't ruin my life. I hope, I dream of doing it right. And I dream that, you know, that the truth gets to be clear, you know, the truth of my life and who I am gets to be clarified. I dream that trans people aren't going to have to be up for debate, and that, you know, somehow, some way that I can use my experiences and the parts of my, the deep, deep, deep parts of myself that I've taken the time to actually heal, and continue to heal. I'm going to be healing for the rest of my life. That I dream that I'm able to use that in service to humanity and this planet, that I'm able to somehow share the parts of me that will inspire us all to share the beautiful parts of us all, and to keep that going, and that hopefully that somehow will create a chain reaction that'll save the planet, that'll keep us farther from world war and from racism and from the religious extremism that is making us all struggle in accessing God. I feel like I see connections in all of these issues that humankind is struggling with right now. And I only have what, like 60 and change more years to go in my life. Not that I'm really counting, but I just want to use the time that I'm on earth to, I just dream of just using my life and my experience to encourage us all to be better people. To ourselves, to each other, and to the planet.
I look forward to seeing how you live many of those dreams. I really do. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you. I'm like in tears right now. Sorry. Everything is so.
Don't ever be sorry.
All
don't
over
ever,
the place.
Don't ever be sorry for speaking from your heart, because that's what people feel, and that's what the truth is.
Thank you.
I want to ask you one more question, actually, that I have to ask everybody, which is, who are some of the voices that are important to you today?
Oh, the first person that came up was Adrienne Marie Brown. I really resonate with the way that she creates these really beautiful connections between the biology of our planet and like liberation for everyone. I see so much of myself in her. I think like Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, Sonia Renee Taylor.
Those are solid. Those are all incredible.
Raquel Willis, Toni Michelle Williams, you know, Alok V. Manon, Chela Man. They're all really important, pivotal voices and people right now. And Patrice Kohlers, you know, shout out to Patrice Kohlers. May angels always protect her and be around, surround her all the time.
Thank you. You've been listening to VS Voices. My thanks to today's guest, India Moore. If you love our show, please comment, like, and subscribe to wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And as always, please follow me, Amanda DeCadene, on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks for listening in. As part of Victoria's Secret's ongoing commitment to become one of the world's leading advocates for women, VS is making a commitment to represent the rich diversity of all women. From bringing 66 different bra sizes to market, to publicly taking a stand against harmful policies and laws that disadvantage persons from the LGBTQIA+ community, these commitments go to the heart of their mission. They have expanded their partnership with the Point Foundation, making a $200,000 donation to fund scholarships to LGBTQIA plus law students, helping combat the oppression of LGBTQIA plus people and culture. Diversity among those fighting within the legal system for these very basic human rights is essential in creating a positive impact.